Quintillion and its investors and board have been cooperating fully with the Department of Justice in its ongoing investigation since that time.
A fiber optic company based in Anchorage responds to fraud charges filed against its former CEO. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 12th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Puerto Rican and Alaska Native storytellers join forces to shed light on cultural similarities.
We found out they have this character called a vagante. And a vagante is kind of this trickster character, which is a lot like our Tuluka, you know, or the raven.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The former chief executive of an Alaska company working on a massive fiber optic project in the Arctic is charged with committing fraud while she led the company. Ex-Quintillion CEO Elizabeth Pierce is charged with duping New York-based firms into investing more than $250 million in the project. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
Headquartered in Anchorage, Quintillion and its subcontractors have laid hundreds of miles of fiber optic cable in the Arctic to connect northern Alaska communities to high-speed broadband. That system is part of a larger international project that will eventually link North America, Asia, and Europe. Laying the cable both undersea and on land has taken a lot of money. And according to criminal charges unsealed in New York, some of those investments were obtained through deception. That alleged trickery is at the heart of the criminal charges filed against 54-year-old Anchorage resident Elizabeth Pierce. The former Quintillion CEO, who was previously an executive at Alaska Communications, faces one count of wire fraud. A spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, where the charges were filed, refused to comment on the case. But according to a written statement from the U.S. Attorney, one of the companies buying bandwidth on the system tipped off the FBI, leading to an investigation. Quintillion Vice President of External Relations Christina Woolston says Quintillion also discovered the alleged fraud in 2017 and reported it to federal authorities.
Quintillion and its investors and board have been cooperating fully with the Department of Justice in its ongoing investigation since that time.
According to the charges, Pierce forged parts of contracts with telecommunications companies buying that future access to the bandwidth. The charges say the forgery led the investors to believe that their investments would generate hundreds of millions of dollars when, in fact, the system was worth far less. The charges say Pierce was under pressure to make Quintillion appear more valuable, to keep investments flowing in, at least at one point, so the company could finish laying undersea cable before the onset of winter in the Arctic. Pierce was CEO of Quintillion from when it formed in 2012 until resigning in August of 2017. That was for, quote, personal reasons, according to a company press release at the time. The alleged fraud occurred from May 2015 to July 2017. Woolston would not say whether Pierce's resignation was related to the allegations of fraud, and she brushed away questions about the possibility of negative impacts on future investments in Quintillion.
We are extremely disappointed in the situation, as you can imagine, but this remains a transformative project for Alaska, and our investors remain committed to the project.
While the allegations seem to indicate Quintillion benefited from the millions of dollars in investments, and there is no mention of Pierce herself benefiting financially, the company is not named in the charges. The charges also do not name any of the investors nor the five telecommunications companies that were alleged victims of fraud. According to a press release from federal prosecutors, Pierce surrendered to FBI agents and was arrested in New York after the charges were unsealed on Thursday. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
The Senate defeated a series of amendments today to the annual state budget, including efforts to raise permanent fund dividends to the full amount. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski proposed the PFD amendment, which would have set dividends at roughly $2,700. That's the amount they would have been under the legal formula used until 2 years ago. Willikowski says the legislature is ignoring its laws with a lower dividend amount of $1,600 in the budget bill.
Well, we're not following those statutes with the way the bill is currently written.
The PFD amendment failed in an 8-12 vote. Another budget amendment would have added $10 million to the University of Alaska budget. The amendment would have restored most of the money the Senate Finance Committee cut from the House version of the budget. Anchorage Republican Senator Natasha von Imhoff spoke against it.
While cuts and restructuring have been painful for students, for faculty and staff, as well as communities, the university system is just one of 17 statewide departments that we, the legislature, are responsible for funding.
The university funding amendment was defeated, with only the 5 minority caucus Democrats voting in favor of it. The Senate could pass the budget as soon as tonight. It would likely go into a conference committee to resolve differences between the Senate and the House versions. The legislative session is scheduled to end on Sunday, but lawmakers will likely miss that deadline. While voters passed a law in 2006, setting the session at 90 days, the Alaska Constitution allows the session to be up to 121 days. And in an unusual announcement, Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III says he will no longer commit to voting with the Alaska House Majority Caucus.
My hope is being able to step out halfway out of caucus or all the way out of caucus and work with both sides, minority, majority, if they feel like they need my vote to be able to move a budget, to try and work towards a solution that works for everybody and gets us out of here in a reasonable amount of time.
But Keto and Speaker Bryce Edgman both say Keto is still a member of the caucus. The change means that an already thin majority is even more fragile. Keto objected to how House Rules Committee Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux handled Senate Bill 63, a measure that would ban smoking in workplaces across the state. She didn't schedule it for a vote until this week, when the committee changed the bill to allow municipalities to opt out of the smoking ban. The committee version of the bill would also exclude marijuana and electronic cigarettes from the ban. Keto says the process bypassed the support House members had for the bill, and he says he wanted caucus leaders to unite the body.
If we're doing changes in rules committee, that really should be a result of caucus coming together saying, well, we need to fix this so we can get all that support. In this case, it wasn't the caucus coming together, it was an individual, and that's the frustrating thing.
The 22-member majority caucus includes 17 Democrats, 3 Republicans, and 2 independents. The caucus can lose no more than 1 vote to pass bills without seeking votes from the minority Republican caucus. Edgman says he'll continue to talk with Keto about individual votes.
If Representative Keto needs to vote a particular way and, you know, it's a close vote, for example, I think that he'll give me, you know, the opportunity to know in advance, and certainly I'll be working with him so that if we do need his vote on something, that we can have that conversation.
Keto is not running for re-election. The state of Alaska should reduce its use of fossil fuels, increase investment in renewable energy, and plan for a global transition away from oil and gas. Those are some of the first recommendations from Governor Bill Walker's Climate Change Task Force, which met in Fairbanks today. The 20-person team was appointed by the governor this winter to write a state climate change policy. The first draft of that policy is out, and Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk is here to help us understand what is in it. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Zach.
So, Rachel, remind us what this climate change policy is.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Governor Walker appointed this climate task force in December, and they're supposed to come up with a state climate policy and a climate change action plan for the governor by this September. So this is the first draft of that policy, and I should really stress that this is a first draft. It was described to me as the beginning of the conversation, and there will be many more meetings from here, and they say opportunities for public input.
And with that caveat, what's in it?
Well, so there's two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, you could look at this and say it is very ambitious. And on the other hand, you could say it's pretty vague. The overall vision of the document is certainly pretty ambitious. It says there's an economic and ethical imperative to pursue a transition away from fossil fuels to renewables. And I just want to pause on that because it would be kind of a big deal for that to become the official policy of an oil state like Alaska. So, you know, in terms of vision, certainly pretty ambitious. It lays out a really wide range of proposals that touch just about every aspect of life in Alaska. So reducing emissions from state government, from industry, diversifying the economy away from a reliance on oil and gas, investments in infrastructure and renewable energy, climate-friendly building codes, better climate change education in the schools, lots of stuff. On the other hand, it leaves out the details. There are not a lot of numbers, hardly any numbers. And so that's the hard part, of course. So, you know, it recommends that we reduce carbon emissions by 2030, but it doesn't say by how much. So it doesn't say how you'd pay for any of this. And obviously, that's the hard part. The task force says a lot of that will get filled in the months to come.
And it seems like there's another big elephant in the room.
Yeah, and so this really is the big one. I mean, you know, for Alaska, tackling climate change comes with this fact, which is we're an oil state. We rely on the oil industry. Burning oil contributes to climate change. So what do we do about that? And that's not really addressed in this plan. You know, I think when most people think of Alaska's climate emissions, our contribution to climate change, they're probably thinking about the oil that comes out of the ground on the North Slope. And this plan isn't addressing that. It's really focused on the emissions that we produce as Alaskans in the state, you know, from transportation and power generation, you know, from industry on the North Slope, but not the carbon emissions from oil that is produced here and burned, you know, say in California. So the draft says Alaska needs to prepare for an energy transition and rely less on oil, but it stops short of calling for limiting oil production. And in fact, Governor Bill Walker has been very clear that the state has to do both. We have to continue resource development and tackle climate change. How you do that remains the big question. And so that's not something that this plan is really tackling.
And let me just ask you as, you know, a big picture question. You cover energy and environment. Is it feasible to you to have a report on the state's kind of status with climate change that doesn't address production on the North Slope and the kind of bigger picture of oil and gas development?
I think yes and no. I think that the climate task force would say, look, we are working on what we can control as a state, which is, you know, our emissions as people that live here. And it's up to the market. It's up to the international market to say what happens with all that oil on the North Slope. It's not up to the state of Alaska, you know, how much oil comes out of the ground and whether that's valuable and whether there's a market for it. Of course, there are state policies that encourage oil production, you know, and whether the state should continue that is, you know, a big political question.
Okay. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Zach.
That's reporter Rachel Waldholtz with Alaska's Energy Desk. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two rookie mushers are among those setting out to tackle the Kobuk 440.
This is the first time that we have ever raced, and it's a long race. So for sure, we're going to stick together as much as possible, you know?
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Alaska's government doesn't have a sustainable budget plan in place, and that uncertainty is bad for business. That was the central message from bankers and economists during an economic summit in Juneau this week, sponsored by Anchorage-based North Rim Bank. North Rim President Joe Shearhorn says the bank, along with others from the Alaska Bankers Association, is advocating for a fiscal plan that has three key pieces. First, a draw from permanent fund earnings.
So a portion of the earnings from the permanent fund to fund state government, as well as provide for dividends to the citizens of the state.
Second, Shearhorn says lawmakers should continue their efforts to decrease the cost of government. And third, a broad-based tax.
Whether it's an income tax or a sales tax, that is up to the legislature.
The Democrat-led majority in the state House have pushed for an income tax. They voted last year to put one in place, but the Senate Republican majority has consistently opposed it. The struggle to find the right balance of revenue and spending has had real consequences for the state. Economist Musheen Gutabi studies how much additional investment has been lost due to policy uncertainty. Gutabi says he modeled what could have happened if the state had decided on a fiscal plan sooner.
And I come up with basically, in the 3 years in which we've been experiencing these difficulties, there could have been somewhere between $630 to $2 billion additional dollars in investment.
There are some bright spots in the state's economic outlook. Job losses have slowed. Oil prices have been inching up. The healthcare industry has continued to expand and add jobs, as well as the military, which has increased spending and is expected to bring more jobs into the state. About 400 people from around Alaska and elsewhere converged on the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center this week to talk about how residents of the state's rural and remote communities can reduce high energy costs. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports on the 20th Rural Energy Conference.
Organizers say turnout for this year's conference is good and interest is keen in finding solutions to the growing problem of sky-high energy costs in Alaskan communities located far off the grid.
What this conference is really about, it's about bringing people together to share experiences, share stories on what works, what doesn't work, what direction they're going, try to make sure people have access to the kind of resources that they need to make sure their projects are developed in a successful way.
Gwen Holdman directs the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF, which helps the Alaska Energy Authority organize the biennial conference. Holdman has attended all 20 of the events, and she says they've evolved in recent years as technological solutions to the problem of high energy costs have emerged.
20 years ago, there was really not that much going on in the terms of like innovative projects, integration of renewables. There really wasn't too much happening. There was a lot of interest, but not much was occurring at that time. And over time, that's really changed.
Holdman says earlier conferences focused on improving existing power generating systems. She says that changed a few years ago when the price of diesel and fuel oil rose sharply and utilities, especially those that serve smaller communities, started looking for alternatives.
After we saw the fuel spikes in 2008, there was a huge increase in activity.
Holdman says that's why conferees are talking a lot more now about employing technologies that improve efficiencies and about renewable energy sources such as woody biomass, wind, and solar to reduce the use of diesel to generate power. And she says industry is taking notice.
There's a lot of interest from companies in using Alaska as kind of an early adopter, first mover sort of market because our energy prices are higher. And so things work here today in ways that they don't necessarily work from an economic standpoint in other places in the United States right now.
Renewable energy expert Chris Rose agrees Alaska has become a leader in improving the microgrids that distribute power to small, isolated communities. But he says Alaska is still catching up on using alternative energy to generate heat power.
In the lower 48 and in much of the rest of the world, renewable energy is actually mainstream. It's moved further, faster than even in places in Alaska.
Rose is executive director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He says the state has more than 70 alternative energy technology projects underway, and he says the growing use of those technologies is reflected in the presentations being given at the conference and the conversations going on in the hallways.
How to make those projects better? How are they performing? What can we do on the human capacity side to make sure that we've got the right operations and maintenance? What can we be doing on an ongoing basis to update control systems that marry the diesel engines to the renewable energy project, whatever that might be?
Both Rose and Holdman agree that Alaskans will have to leverage the state's growing reputation as a proving ground for microgrids and renewable energy because state and federal funding like the Alaska Energy Authority's Renewable Energy Fund has dried up. So, Holdman says Alaskans must look to the private sector.
Some of our rural communities have the highest energy costs anywhere in the United States. And while that's a real challenge for us, it actually presents this opportunity in terms of being able to test new technologies, really gain expertise in that area, and potentially be able to market our expertise as Alaskans into other emerging places.
The Rural Energy Conference continues through noon Thursday at the Westmark. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The lawsuit of Dolores Hunter against Philip Morris USA went to trial in Bethel yesterday for the third time in 7 years. The trial could have wide-reaching implications for the tobacco company, but in their opening statements, the attorneys chose to focus on the legacy of a single Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta man whose early death has resulted in 14 years of litigation. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports.
Benjamin Francis was a musician and dog musher who spent his life in the Lower Yukon's villages. A trained fire chief and forestry technician, he helped his community where he could. In St. Mary's, he briefly served as acting chief of police and fire chief. When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act passed, he helped translate the bill into Yupik for his neighbors. Francis was also a smoker. His friends think he started when he was about 10 years old. He tried and failed to quit, and when he was diagnosed with lung cancer, he told his common-law wife, Dolores Hunter, that he was sorry. Francis died of cancer in 2004. He was 52 years old. Hunter and her two sons have been suing Philip Morris for damages for years now. In his opening statement, Hunter's attorney, Don Bauermeister, claimed the tobacco company deliberately misled smokers like Francis for decades. The fraud was real, he told the jury. Francis started smoking as a child, he argued, for instance, because companies like Philip Morris marketed their products to children, and adults were unaware of exactly how dangerous cigarettes could be. It was excused, he said. His parents didn't know, his teachers didn't know. They were fooled, so he was fooled. Francis also favored Marlboro Lights, said Bauermeister, a brand Philip Morris had misleadingly marketed as a healthier brand of cigarette. In his own opening statement, Philip Morris attorney Stan Davis didn't dispute that smoking may have contributed to Francis's death or that Philip Morris's past marketing was misleading, but he claimed that Francis rarely saw Philip Morris ad campaigns, and when he did, they didn't fool him. Doctors repeatedly told Francis to quit, said Davis. He knew cigarettes were bad for him. This is a fraud case, Davis reminded the jury. They're here to determine whether Francis was tricked or fooled. And he says Francis knew the risks. He just chose to smoke anyway. The attorney's opening statements each lasted about an hour yesterday morning. They expect the rest of the trial to last 3 to 4 weeks. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Kotsarillas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Sixteen dog teams took off from Kotzebue this afternoon at the start of the 2018 Kobuk 440. Leading the pack across the ice this year was Iditarod's Rookie of the Year and past 440 champion, Jesse Holmes. Other big names in this year's race include Hugh Neff and French-born musher Nicholas Petit. Petit finished second in this year's Iditarod with many of the same dogs he left with today. He was candid about his goals for the 2018 Kobuk.
I wouldn't mind winning again.
Missing from the starting line was Kotzebue's own Catherine Keith. She withdrew from the race just 2 days ago, but two of her handlers are competing with dogs from the kennel she runs with her partner, Iditarod champion John Baker.
This is the first time that we have ever raced, and it's a long race. So for sure, we're going to stick together as much as possible, you know?
That's rookie Maya Burnoff. She and her best friend Julie Floatlin moved to Kotzebue from Norway to handle for the Team Baker kennel. They're hoping to run their first ever race side by side. The Norwegian rookie says they're both just thrilled to be there. As much as he's hoping to win, Petit echoed Burnoff's sentiments, saying he says what he's looking forward to the most is the journey.
The beautiful scenery and the nice people everywhere.
16 mushers left just after 12:30 this afternoon, although 17 were originally registered. They'll race the more than 200 miles to Kobuk and then back to Kotzebue, with the finisher expected to arrive Sunday morning. The cultures of Puerto Ricans living in the Bronx and Alaska Natives may seem worlds apart, but a new production from the Alaska Native Heritage Center will shed light on some surprising similarities. The collaborative performance between a Bronx-based theater and the Heritage Center will bridge the geography gulf with technology. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
The Raven is a central character in many Alaska Native stories, a creative trickster always getting into trouble. And it turns out the Raven has a counterpart in the Bronx.
And we're just, you know, talking about each other's stories and all that. And we found out they have this character called a vagante. And a vagante is kind of this trickster character, which is a lot like our tulukak, or the raven.
Steve Blanchette is the community engagement officer for the Alaska Native Heritage Center and one of the artistic directors for A Tale of Two Tricksters. The program is a collaborative effort between ANHC and the Pregones Puerto Rican Traveling Theater. The two groups have been swapping traditional stories for a couple years now, trying to find common themes in their cultures and experiences. Blanchette says this story that developed involves two tricksters, one from each culture, switching places and interacting with the various nuances of the other's land. In their journeys, the two learn about the other culture's struggles.
And so the concept is these two ravens seeing each other and having a conversation about bears. And bears as the physical thing that we know as bears here in Alaska, but bears is also things like gentrification or climate change, and that the bear can take many forms.
The two characters end up finding similarities between their metaphorical bears, such as climate change driving Alaska Native people out of their homes. In a similar way, gentrification is moving some Puerto Rican families out of their generational homes. One thing that sets A Tale of Two Tricksters apart from most conventional programs is that the performances will be taking place in Anchorage and the Bronx at the same time. By using pre-recorded video exchanges and in-person interactions, the two groups are hoping to bridge the geographical distance and bring the collaboration to life. The two groups will send their live feeds to a technical crew in Manhattan, who'll be mixing and broadcasting the joint performance. Blanchette says it'll look a little bit like using FaceTime on your phone.
So it's this collaboration of three different places. So it's kind of like a VJ, video jockey. That's going to be kind of mixing it up.
Blanchette says the organizations will have audiences all over the country for the event. He hopes they'll walk away knowing more about the similarities these diverse cultures share.
What we want to portray and get out there in the message is what these different bears are. What are the things that we're dealing with in both of our areas? So all these different things that we're talking about that are just really important to both our peoples, and also to so many people all around the world. So those are the type of messages that we're trying to tell and talk about.
A Tale of Two Tricksters will take place at 4 p.m. Alaska time, 8 p.m. in New York, on Saturday, April 14th. It will also be streamed online at the Alaska Native Heritage Center's website, alaskanative.net. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And finally tonight, a correction. In a story yesterday about the sale of three Alaska newspapers, it was incorrectly stated that former media mogul Conrad Black was deceased. He is not. Black is still alive and 73 years old. That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Teresa Kotsarillis in Bethel, and Zoe Kruskin in Kotzebue. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.